One year after the new Crown Point Iron Company was formed in 1845, the company town Hammondville was established. In 1873, Plattsburgh reporter George Bixby visited the mining town of Hammondville. Around the time Bixby visited, the mines were yielding 125 tons of ore a day to be shipped to Troy.
Let's take a ride on the Crown Point Iron Railroad. Aboard we jump, the bell rings, and away we go, winding gracefully around the sharp curves.
The Crown Point Iron Company's railroad was built to transport the ore from the mines at Hammondville to the forges at Ironville, and later to the furnaces on the lake shore at Crown Point. It also connected most of Crown Point's scattered settlements.
A mile up, we stop a moment at the Crown Point post office to take on a case or two of goods. Then on goes the train up the valley of Putnam Creek. The track continually cutting S's as it winds along the hillside. The engine labors heavily. With a sharp turn, we glide over a trestle 50 feet high. 2.5 miles up, we pass the road leading to Crown Point Center. 3 more miles, the grade becomes steeper. Onward we go until 8 miles are passed when we come to Irondale, rightly named, owned by the company, and wearing the black, sooty look which is common to all iron manufacturing places. A small village lies at the north side of the track, and you are at once struck with the air of neatness which its white cottages bear. High rocky bluffs rise to the left, and here we are up above the old charcoal blast furnace. Another trestle and a sweep around a huge curve, and then Hammondville, where the great Crown Point mines are located. We gaze about on one of the roughest, ruggedest, rockiest scenes. Huge bare rocks arise to the left, while in front, belonging to the same range, is Knob Mountain, a bare round rock having a perpendicular precipice upon the western side from 500 to 800 feet high.
Looking at it now, it's hard to believe Hammondville helped launch the Industrial Revolution. Here in what is now Wild Forest, pianos once played strains of Mozart, and violin concertos were lifted by the mountain breeze. The road glimmered with the shiny blue slag created by the heat of the furnace. There were powerhouses, hoists, a store, office, 2 churches, rows of clapboard houses and tenements built for the laborers and their families. Music was important to this community. At least 2 pianos were hauled up by train. Community members played in the Hammondville Golden Coronet Band. Moses Plouffe, a local violin maker, had a famous string duet that used to play for the dances and other festivities that made the gatherings in the famed mining camp a great event. For the athlete, there was the Hammondville Bessemers baseball team. The population had grown to 1,000. At the most prominent position of the town was the superintendent's house. And the man, standing alone on the stone steps, appraising the site with approving eyes, was the general, John Hammond, owner and operator of the Crown Point Iron Company. The general was a Civil War hero. He was a benefactor, a devout Protestant trying to uphold a moral way of life for the residents here in Hammondville. This company town had rules. No swearing, no alcohol, and no mistreatment of horses. The Hammonds bred horses, and the general, of course, had a profound fondness for his Morgan horse, Pink, who fought alongside him in the Civil War. Melvin Turner, the village doctor, also played violin, although apparently without Moses Plouffe's skill. It was said, when Doc was not busy dealing out pills, liniments, and other concoctions that were warranted to kill or cure, he was busy rasping away on the violin, and the squeaks and groans that came from the violin would rival those from Doc's patients when he was extracting their teeth. As word spread of jobs in the community, single workers and families came from the Erie Canal, Ireland, Sweden, and Quebec to join in the general's company town community. The town was picturesque by lamplight, but you don't have to look too deeply to see the darker parts of the mining community. The accidents.
November 24, 1879. Henry Sumner, laborer in the Penfield pit, was pushed from his position by a machine drill which he was working, and thrown from the ledge, falling 35 feet and landing among a quantity of loose rocks. It is a wonder he was not instantly killed. His right arm was broken and side badly bruised. It is thought he will recover.
Elizabethtown Post and Gazette, 1881. Big Hans, a Swede, was buried under a huge chunk of ore weighing some 10 tons. Another Swede was so severely injured that after lingering in intense pain, he died in the evening.
An Irishman named McNamara, whose arm and leg were mangled fearfully, will probably recover.
Big Hans, a Swede, an Irishman, McNamara, where you came from seemed a huge part of who you were. And despite the general's mandate to abstain from alcohol, it was there, and it was drunk.
Plattsburgh Sentinel, 1878. Michael Gibbons, formerly of Port Henry, was stabbed in the back of the neck by a drunken Swede at the Crown Point Mines Saturday evening.
Underneath the veneer of a wholesome town, perhaps, there were tensions inside the tidy clabbered town. The seemingly inexhaustible supply of wood used to make charcoal was running out. After 1861, wood for fuel became so scarce that the Hammond furnace could only be run about three-quarters of the time. In 1872, the Crown Point Iron Company closed the Hammondville furnace permanently, though mining there still continued. The insatiable thirst for charcoal had all but wiped out the forest. The Crown Point Iron Company made two big investments. The same year the Hammondville furnace closed, two coal-powered Bessemer furnaces designed by Alexander Holly were built along the lake at Monitor Bay, then called Hammond's Wharf. It was described as a double blast furnace of mammoth proportions. Without a local source of wood or coal, iron companies needed to bring in anthracite coal. Trains and canal boats were transporting coal from Pennsylvania mines north to Albany and here. On their way back south, those same boats and rail cars would be loaded with iron ore and pig iron. The second big investment the company made was a course for a 13-mile-long, narrow-gauge railroad that would speed the transport of iron ore in the mountains to the furnaces at the wharf. In addition to transporting the iron, the new Crown Point Iron Company Railroad had a passenger car and a mail car. That's how Bixby traveled to Hammondville. The new railroad became the main form of east-west transportation connecting Hammondville and Ironville with the lakeside Bessemer furnaces. After Charles Hammond died in 1873, only 3 weeks after the tragic drowning of his son Thomas and family, the surviving son, the General John Hammond, was the only Hammond left in the family business. The deaths of Thomas and Charles Hammond not only left General Hammond as the sole local stockholder in the Crown Point Iron Company, it also left him without allies in the company and without the trusted counsel of his family. And there were other challenges. The company's first major labor dispute in 1876. There was also intense competition from Minnesota, where iron was easier and cheaper to extract and transport. The mines were closed and sold to American Steel and Wire Company in the 1890s. Some miners stayed on to dismantle the town. Piece by piece, homes were destroyed and burned. The company valuables were loaded onto the train. As the train advanced toward the east, the tracks were pulled up behind it. And so, Hammondville vanished. It is today much like it was in 1942 when Eugene Barker visited.
Where that community flourished, there is now pasture, fast being taken over by raspberry and blueberry bushes and sapling birches. Fearsome, yawning chasms of the open mines here and there on the mountaintop, some of them already hidden in dense woods, will remain to excite the imagination of a casual visitor and to challenge some antiquarian to a hazardous day's exploration amongst the concealing thickets and repossessing forests.